Paper 38, section 7, which is old single column, page 422. Okay, so recall that we're doing the ministering spirits of the local universe. In a general way, in this paper, then we'll get into lots of specifics about the seraphim in the next paper. But we're in the last part of this one. You can see they're going to give us a little bit on that which is not seraphim, and we start with the cherubim and the sanabim, and you've got. I mean, you know, just comment on that. I mean, everyone has, of course, heard of cherubim, or at least cherubs, the Michelangelo idea of, little baby-like cherubs. That's not what we're talking about. We're also not talking about, more of a biblical idea, which if you try to dig through the complexity and variability and vague things that are said in that sort of a context or near biblical context, it seems like cherubim or maybe some sort of a composite being like a lot of those Near Eastern mythical sorts of creatures, half human, half animal of some sort, whatnot. Okay, so nothing like any of that. Nothing off of some Assyrian relief wall or anything like that. Okay, no. These are just downstepped seraphim, basically. And the same basic idea as a seraphim, just brought down the hierarchy a little bit more so they can draw all the more closely to us and our doings. Yeah?
Quick question. How in the world did they ever start with the babies, with the little baby forms, the little bare bottoms?
Well, if you think about what's vaguely in human mythology about angels, it's clear from the vague references that whatever seraphim and cherubim are, seraphim are superior to cherubim. Just forget about the Urantia book, but just in human thought. Okay, so think about if you start depicting a seraphim in a very anthropomorphic way as some sort of an adult, where would your mind start going if you're kind of thinking some sort of way subordinate to an adult? You're going to start thinking more childlike. So you can imagine how it could evolve, into some sort of, little round baby-like form, just to capture that spirit of that differential of subordinate to seraphim. All right, so here they're not only going to use that name cherubim, and give you a, you have to rethink what that means, but they're adding another name to it, sanabim. So unlike with seraphim, where even though there's so-called positive and negative pairing to seraphim, a spirit polarity, a differential, it's not so great that you really feel the need to use a separate name. You're going to call them both seraphim. Here, you will call both the positive and negative in a general way cherubim, but they give you another name just to remind you. As we're about to read, it's all the more significant, this difference. They're all the more dependent upon each other. All the less that they can function separately. Okay, so remember how we were going through that a bit last time, remembering how as you come down the hierarchy of angels, starting all the way at Supernaphim, the more farther you come down, the more it is that they will need to work in a pair to do certain things. And so now you've come all the way down that that hierarchy to the point where they literally have two separate names, you know, to indicate the pair. All right, let's just read some, see what we've got.
Seven, cherubim and sanubim. In all essential endowments, cherubim and sanubim are similar to seraphim. They have the same origin, but not always the same destiny. They are wonderfully intelligent, marvelously efficient, touchingly affectionate, and almost human. They are the lowest order of angels, hence all the nearer of kin to the more progressive types of human beings on the evolutionary worlds.
Okay, so right away we see it again. You know, we know not to absolutize that last statement. You know, they are the lowest order of angels. That's a sentence that's relative to the revelation. You know, we've gone through this over and over, reminding ourselves that it's the lowest order that they're allowed to reveal. Okay. And you say, well, I don't know. I mean, aren't you rationalizing that? That sounds like a pretty, you know, definitive statement with no wiggle room. Yes. Well, you know, here I could even, just to make the point, you know, when you, like I mentioned, you know, they refer to that lower order of angels a few times. And like, for instance, when they're talking about the wake of the Caligastia Rebellion, and they're talking about, you know, what kind of a sort of an ad hoc planetary administration they set up, you know, they set up in the wake of that. And they're kind of rattling through the different people involved. And they talk about the chiefs of seraphim and cherubim. Okay, so in other words, you've got a chief for the seraphim and a chief for the cherubim. And then they say the director general of subordinate angelic life. Okay, and if you're just, you know, reading through that, you're, oh, okay, they must be talking about the cherubim. It's like, they mentioned the cherubim specifically. Okay, so to say subordinate angelic life, you're talking about something below cherubim. Okay, and so, you know, it's very definitive right there that there's a lower order of angels. No wiggle room. You know, and so you have to go, oh, so I've found a mistake in the book or something. Or you go, oh, that's right, I'm supposed to remember not to think in simple-minded absolutist terms. I have to always think about relative to the revelatory limitations when they say something. Yeah, all the sentences are relative to the limitations. So I have to interpret them in that light. So it's just a simple example of how you can't, you know, you're not going to teach a computer to interpret the revelation for you. You have to be objective. You have to be thinking above, you know, the lower level details like that and properly interpret it. Okay? And of course, once again, as we see so many times, for going down a hierarchy of angels, there's someone who fills the place where that, you know, lower order would be talked about. You know, if you flip to the last section of this paper, instead of that section on that lowest order of angels that are unrevealed, you see a discussion about the midway creatures again. Yeah. That parallel phenomenon of creatures that are, you know, especially the secondary midwayers, that are at the same level as that lower unrevealed order of angels. So just as we always seen, I mean, it's there to be recognized, you know, that if you're talking about the, you know, technically the ministering spirits, midway creatures are not ministering spirits literally, you know, but there they are in the paper. See, so again, he's like, oh, well, whoever wrote this doesn't even know that midway creatures aren't ministering spirits. Or, oh yeah, right, they're putting it in there as a placeholder, a little reminder. Okay, so that sort of sophisticated relationship to the revelation, so that you, you know when you need to fill in the blanks, when you need to constrain yourself very rigidly to what's said, you know, et cetera. You've got to be flexible, but truthful, not just randomly flexible to make it fit your preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices, right? but truthfully flexible. And that's an art form that you have to develop. You know, none of us were born with that, the ability to properly interpret the revelation. What we were born with, what the Father gave us by birth, was the ability to misinterpret the revelation. That's what he gave us, you know, by nature, not what we need to properly interpret it. That he didn't make you an adult to begin with, like he made the seraphim, cherubim, whatnot, midway creatures. He made them adults to begin with. That isn't the way we started. We started as ignorant children without the ability to do anything correctly to begin with. We have to figure out how to do everything. You know, by and large, the basics, these beings, hit the ground running. Now, we know they go through a lot of education, you know, for their specific jobs. But, you know, so many of the things that we have to learn, they have automatically. All right, so let's see, is there anything else in there that, just the stressing that even when we get into the details and we start to appreciate, you know, how relatively much deeper down in the hierarchy cherubim get than seraphim, you notice what they're saying, that in terms of, the spirit of their nature, you know, definitely the truth of their nature, that with the core of their nature in a more literal, factual sense as well, is just like the seraphim. In all essential endowments, cherubim and seraphim are similar to seraphim. See, not the same, but definitely similar. So, like I said, think of them as a downstepping of seraphim rather than, you know, a really separate phenomenon. Okay.
Cherubim and seraphim are inherently associated, functionally united. One is an energy positive personality, the other energy negative. The right hand deflector or positively charged angel is the cherubim, the senior or controlling personality. The left hand deflector or negatively charged angel is the seraphim, the complement of being. Each type of angel is very limited in solitary function. Hence, they usually serve in pairs. When serving independently of their seraphic directors, they are more than ever dependent on mutual contact and always function together.
See, so there you see, especially that last point, you know, if they don't have the benefit of the environment of the superior seraphim that they're sort of immersed in, they must function, you know, as a pair, hence giving them actual separate names. Because the other ones sometimes needed to, but, you know, there were, you know, just by themselves, they could still work separately in some areas. Here you've got, no, if they're by themselves, nothing. They can't do anything without their complement. Yep. Yeah, okay, I was just going to get to that, yeah. Okay, so for those in the web, he was asking about that weird word, deflector. So let's, so they're choosing some words there and describing this energy polarity. Okay, remember I mentioned, you know, how they said spirit polarity before. Now, you remember we're talking about a literal energy fact, okay? So first step is just to notice they say energy positive personality. Okay, does that mean that the personality that came from the Father is different for cherubim than for seraphim? No. It's not literally the existential personality that has any differential. Those are identical, you know, in terms of being a person, creature personality. What that personality personalizes, the energy form, you know, so that here, by personality, you mean personalized self. Okay. And, you know, same way when they do it later on, let's see, where was it, somewhere else in there, they said a similar thing. You know, just appreciating that, you know, every personality is absolutely unique, yes, but they're all creature personalities, if we're talking about a creature, and so they're the same. in that sense. So when they use the word personality in a sense like this, where they're talking about a differential, and they don't mean literally the personality, they mean the self, the energy self. Okay, so you have these two energy selves that are very, very distinctly different and dependent upon each other to be an energy whole. That makes for a very interesting personality identification. Talk about that existential personality. And how that personality engages one of these individuals. It's the personality of any one of them is only going to be able to fully manifest when they're joined at the hip, energy-wise. That's going to be a fact about them that's very different than what we understand about ourselves as a personal self. Okay, and then they choose that very curious word of deflector to obviously they're trying to suggest something. So let's think about what would they be trying to suggest. You know, they're saying that there's a polarity that's set up. But they're using that word deflector, apparently, it seems, if you think about it, to indicate that you have sort of an energy hole that's engaging them, or however you want to think about this, which two hands are inserted into the middle of it, and the right hand deflects it off to one side, and the left hand deflects it off to the other side, and establishes a polarity. So they seem to be indicating that their nature, that you don't have sort of a polarized input, but it gets polarized as it engages them. That as that energy comes into them, it's deflected into a polarity. Okay, that seems to be the suggestion there. You know, that it's just, you know, it's veered away gently, you know, to each side, quote unquote, whatever that polarity is, that differential is. It's deflected off of a center point to each side, and now you have a voltage, you know, if you will, you know, across the two of them. So they're always, you know, like I pointed out, they're always trying to give you little clues about physics in the way they describe these beings. You know, like remember how we talked about the use of the word stationary, you know, and thinking that through clearly and recognizing that it was something much more profound than just, okay, I'm stationary because I'm not moving right now, you know. That's not what they meant. All right, let's see. What else do we have there? That last comment. You know, you're left wondering, again, about the physics of it. When serving independently of their seraphic directors, your first thought is that, you know, they're just very dependent upon someone giving them proper direction. You know, here, you do this next, now do that. But it's probably much more literal than that. You know, there's probably some sort of an energy presence aspect to the seraphim that allows them to function more independently. You know, in a sense, it's sort of getting in between them and allowing them to be separate, you know, and maybe kind of encompassing them. You know, this thing that strikes me when I read that is it sounds a lot like a child prior to roughly age 16, you know, that's still mindily connected to their biologic parents, you know, where, you know, their use of the mind energy system, that child, is in a sense sort of encompassed still by the biologic parents' use of the mind energy system, you know, and it allows that child to appear to be an independent phenomenon, but it actually isn't. You know, it's still very dependent upon the scaffolding, if you will, of its parents' engagement of the mind energy system until roughly age 16, and then it can use it on its own, you know, separately. So that appears what you have here. See, the seraphim provides a scaffolding then it makes it appear that that cherubim or sanabim is able to function independently, but they actually can't. Yeah, take it away and no. Yep.
With humans, after a certain age in their early teens, they will separate the mind cells from their parents. But here...
Right, here they don't.
They don't.
Right. I mean, the cherubim are like this, unless, you know, I mean, there's a little exception. If they're but in general, yes, these are this way until the finite end of the finite age. Yeah.
Got a question.
Mm-hmm.
If energy is positive and negative, is it not possible that the deflection is to the appropriate being? Negative deflects positive, positive deflects negative?
Well, I mean, again, we don't know anything about the physics. You know, we don't know exactly what the inputs are at all, you know, in any way, shape, or form here. So, like I said, you just can start to kind of speculate why they would use a word like deflect. Because, see, deflect, you know, I mean, doesn't imply that the separation is there to begin with. It implies that you start, you know, together, and it's very gradually being veered, you know, away from a straight line. I mean, that's what the word deflect implies. You know, that it's being bent away, you know, rather than just, you know, it already is separated and then just plugs in. So that's what I'm saying. I mean, it's a curious word. It's obviously a very curious word. And so it opens up this speculation. I mean, I obviously don't know the final answer, but... Yep.
Could it be referring to, I thought immediately when you, with the deflection aspect, that perhaps they deflect, are they referring to motion? That they deflect to the right or they deflect to the left and that gives them the opposite?
Well, again, it's just like, I mean, that, you know, like when we talk about a positive and a negative charge, you know, literal electric charge, okay? Since currently scientists don't have any idea what a charge is, you know, those are just words, you know, and you just think of some sort of a magical difference between two things. You call one positive and one negative, okay? Technically what they are is a particular type of motion, and they're in opposite senses, okay? Like if you want to just think about it simplistically, if one was a clockwise rotation, the other one would be a counterclockwise rotation. That's the difference between positive and negative, okay? So, literally what's going on here, I can't say, like I said, but just, you know, deflect is a very curious word. It implies that they're somehow dynamically involved in the differentiation process rather than just attuning themselves to a pre-existent differential. Okay. Right, again, you know, just that bending, you know. Yeah. Does it bend it back or does it bend it, you know, away? Right, so. All right, let's see. Okay, so let's get some more here.
Cherubim and Sanabim are the faithful and efficient aids of the seraphic ministers, and all seven orders of seraphim are provided with these subordinate assistants. Cherubim and Sanabim serve for ages in these capacities, but they do not accompany seraphim on assignments beyond the confines of the local universe.
Okay, so they're very definitively, you know, obviously designed to be the assistants. So this downstepping from seraphim is basically for seraphim to make up for the downreach limitations of a seraphim, you know. They, rather than the seraphim having the downreach internally, that's separated off as a separate being, that downreach, quote unquote. Okay, and so they're really just there to serve the seraphim. And then you've got that last little statement. So apparently, and again, we'll see there's a little qualification to this, but in general here, you've downstepped to the point where the creative mother spirit can't plug them into a higher womb of mind. So they can't go outside of the local universe. They're confined to the local universe. So, you know, a little reminder that there are a lot of beings besides mortals that, you know, for the entire finite age are dependent upon the creative mother spirit to be minded. You know, she's always going to have to be minding them. No matter how deeply settled and light in life the local universe becomes, you know, they're never going to be plugged into the reflective mother spirits for mind. They're going to always be dependent upon her. Okay.
Beyond light.
Well, I mean, you know, once the grand universe is settled in light and life, everything changes. But you know, as long as we're short of the grand universe being settled in light and life, no matter how settled the local universe is, they're obviously, you know, stuck here. They'd come unplugged. You know, if they were standing on the border and you pushed them out, they'd come unplugged and lose consciousness. All right.
The cherubim and Sanabin are the routine spirit workers on the individual worlds of the systems. On a non-personal assignment and in an emergency, they may serve in the place of a seraphic pair, but they never function, even temporarily, as attending angels to human beings. That is an exclusive seraphic privilege.
And most likely, it's a privilege because it's an ability. You know, it's literal, I'm sure. And again, because they're downstepped, you know, they're pointing out that there's certain abilities they just don't have. They can't be in charge of a soul. They can't take possession of a soul any more than I could. I'm too far down in the hierarchy of things to be able to take possession of a soul. So are they. Now, non-personal things, you know, which means, you know, not very spiritual things, you know, as well, you know, in an emergency, okay, they can do some basic mechanical level things. But that's it. Let's see.
What does exactly mean by attending angels?
Oh, you have guardian angels. I mean, that's what they mean by attending angels. You know, and using a very soft term there like that. We're not talking about guardians of destiny, but, you know, but just, you know, any attending angel. Even when you got a group of 1,000 and, you know, it's in very rudimentary stages. So even at the lowest levels of tending for mortals, you know, they can't do it because they couldn't, you know, do the things that might need to be done, you know, which we don't really know what they are, but, you know, whatever those, you know, literal factual issues are, they couldn't do it. They don't have the hands for it, quote unquote. All right.
When assigned to a planet, cherubim enter the local courses of training, including a study of planetary usages and languages. The ministering spirits of time are all bilingual, speaking the language of the local universe of their origin and that of their native super universe. By study in the schools of the realms, they acquire additional tongues. Cherubim and Sanabin, like seraphim, and all other orders of spirit beings are continuously engaged in efforts of self-improvement. Only such as the subordinate beings of power control and energy direction are incapable of progression. All creatures having actual or potential personality volition seek new achievements.
Right, so except for those power beings that aren't actually beings, but just entities, because they're not persons, you're going to have anything that, you know, notice that not just actual, but potential. If you've got something that's potentially personal, you know, that's pre-personal in some sense, either a thought adjuster or you prior to roughly age 6, okay, you are a kind of a self that is presaging the kind of volitional accomplishments that you'll do once you are a personalized self. You know, the adjuster has been working, you know, like, you know, one of the adjusters in this room, you know, who knows how long it's been out in service, vectoring towards that future point when eventually personality will encompass it, you know, when you fuse with it. You know, so as a potential personality, it's been working on progressing for a long, long, long time. You know, perhaps trillions and trillions of years, right? You know, who knows how long our adjusters have been in play. All right, so that's kind of an interesting little tidbit to point out that there's a, you know, we've spoken to that a number of times, the quasi-personal nature that you have prior to roughly age six. You know, the whole universe is like that. Anything that's actual or potentially personal, see, to take the time out, and then it is a person. You know, if you view it from eternity, then it is a person. Right? So, you know, when it comes to something that's existential, like a personality, you know, it's going to be effectively in play, even if it isn't literally, temporally, experientially in play. It'll be in play in a very indirect, mysterious way, but it'll be in play. Because it's in play in eternity. Right.
What now, about additional tongues?
Mm-hmm.
Could they be talking about?
Okay, so I mean, if they get assigned here, I mean, they'll learn all kinds of different, you know, human languages. They'll learn English and Spanish and, you know, Swahili and whatnot. Yeah. Mm. And it's going to be very much like us learning one of those languages, like they're trying to point out. I mean, their mind is not that different than ours, so. Same way you have to go through learning a language, they have to go through that. You know, so think about it, you know, an angel that's been serving here for ages, you know, I mean, they probably know thousands of human languages. You know, they know all, you know, all the tongues that are no longer spoken and whatnot, you know. Yep.
Little question. What are the seven orders of seraphim?
Oh, yeah, I forgot to mention that. Yeah, thank you for that. Backing up there in that third paragraph, when it said, Cherubim and Sanabim are the faithful and efficient aids of the seraphic ministers, and all seven orders of seraphim are provided with these subordinate assistants. That's the next paper, the seven different orders of seraphim. And so whoever asked that, just flip to the first page of the next paper and you'll see. You'll see a list right there in the preface of the seven orders.
I have a question, yep, too. Yep, why why is it only the cherubim that enters the local courses of training? What's the Sanabim?
Oh, okay. See, so there's an example where they're using the word cherubim as a collective term rather than a specific term. Yeah, so they bounce back and forth. So you have to kind of just, you know, and sometimes if you're uncertain, if they're using it in a general instead of the specific, if you keep reading, you'll see, oh, and then they'll mention both of them. Yeah. It's like, oh, okay, they meant it in the general sense. Okay. And sometimes it's only in a different part of the book when they talk about the same thing, and then they'll mention both, and then you know, oh, they were talking about both back there. So you have to, right. In the case of these, I mean, you can tell they're so not independent of each other. You know, it's pretty much a given that if they just say cherubim, that's short for both of them. Yeah. Okay. Let's see. What else do we have in here? Oh. Now that you just to, it occurred to me as you were reading that, you know, we were talking about how much they hit the ground running. You know, issues like knowing the local universe and super universe tongues. You know, I've often wondered about that. I mean, you know, if it's a local universe creature, you know, it may be that the creative mother spirit can just make them and they know the local universe tongue. And then maybe they have to learn the super universe tongue. when they're going through that initial schooling. I don't know how much language is there, you know, right from the first second of, you know, after creation. I would think that in their case, you know, there would be no development of mind that was needed. You know, like with us, when we get to the first mansion world, we can't learn the local universe tongue yet. We don't have a sophisticated enough mind yet to consciousize that language. And so we have to have that bridging language. It's basically like a mortal language, that tongue of Satania, that you can consciousize until your mind gets sophisticated enough that you're actually able to consciousize the local universe tongue, let alone the super universe tongue. You know, see, but they wouldn't have any of that developmental thing. I mean, they would, I'm sure they come right, you know, right out of the creative mother spirit, fully capable of incorporating the local universe tongue into their mind. Right? And I just don't know how much learning there is to that incorporation. I don't know, you know.
When we get there, and we only speak English, all of us.
Right.
So
that's why, you know, I mean, if nothing else, you'll have guardian angels there that know English, mm-hmm. right? You know, and if nothing else, they can, you know, interpret between you and others. You know, because someone that came from some other planet, you know, doesn't know English. Right. So initially, you know, that's the reason why everyone needs to learn the tongue of Satania, so the ascenders can talk to each other, because they, you know, it's just like you going somewhere on the planet and you don't know the language, you know, you're plopped into the middle of, you know, Slovakia or something, you know, and you don't know how to communicate. Yeah.
What about the harp?
Okay, now that harp of God thing, remember, that's just a
communication.
Well, yeah, but it's just a device to connect you into the communication circuits. It's not a translator device, you know, between, you know, two people standing next to each other, you know, on the first mansion world. So, you know, like, if you remember, you know, when you read about the Marantia life, they talk about how you have all these interpreters and translators and all this sort of stuff. I mean, yeah, you need all this help in order to interact. Okay. Right, so there's all those Marantia companions, there's all those various beings, the Marantia power supervisors, all these various beings are, you know, there to help you. But it's very important to remember, just because you're going to be communicating mindily, that doesn't somehow mean you translate or transcend language. I mean, right now, if all you know is English, the only kind of mind forms that are in your mind are English mind forms. It's not like there's some sort of a transcendent mind form, you know, that's the same in every language on the planet. No, I mean, an English-shaped word is different than a Spanish-shaped word. You know, and someone looks at your mind, if they don't know English, they can't read that mind shape. They don't know what that word is. See, so they're learning what the mind, you know, forms are. You know, if I think cat, there's a certain form in my mind energy system. And it's an English form. See, like I said, you know, when all the relevators, even if they're very high beings, like a divine counselor, I mean, they had to compose this in English. They had to put English mind forms into their mind energy system. Okay? You know, and then that English mind form gets downstepped, like if it's a divine counselor and they have to use the contact personality, I mean, that literally has to get downstepped through the adjuster, put into the mind of the contact being, and then the secondary midwayer can, oh, that's the word Bob, you know, or whatever, right? And then they can write that down on a piece of paper. I mean, they, you know, so the midwayer has to know English, has to be able to interpret, you know, what the mind form of for cat is in English, etc. So it's all very literal still, even though you're not jiggling air molecules. I mean, a simple way we know that is dreaming. You know? You know, if you start to really learn another language, you'll start to dream in that language. You know, even subconsciously, if you will, you know, your mind can take on those forms. See, so it isn't like there's a, you know, there's a certain mind form and you're just figuring out how to translate that into a different way of jiggling your mouth. You know, but it's the same mind form in every language. That's not the way it works. You know, Katze in German and cat in English are two different shapes in the mind. Okay, and that's why they make your mouth jiggle differently. If they were literally the same form, your mouth would jiggle the same way. It just, you know, bringing in that physics of the mind, you know, helps you to think about, you know, there's a lot of wishful thinking that goes on when you're thinking about humans all coming together as one. I mean, you know, to be kindred minds is a huge challenge, okay? So we're talking literally, you know, the word love in two different languages is a totally different shape in the mind energy system. They aren't immediately in synchrony with each other. They're a square peg in a round hole. They just don't naturally work together. So the two of them can think love all they want and it's still nothing happens, okay? So you have to, you know, basically in order to really be kindred minds, you've got to start getting where you can have mind energy forms that are transcendent of our mortal tongues. You know, you have to be able to have thoughts that transcend words. You know, and if you think about it, there's humans that have said things kind of like that. That idea of coming together in a way that transcends words, transcends language.
Concepts.
Right, see, you know, things that are starting to be kind of effectively local universe tongue, sort of, you know, shapes in the mind energy system. Which is obviously not going to happen very easily when we're very lowly beings, a long ways away from light and life. You know, we can't make mind forms like that yet. So, you know, and you know, once you get the mortals on a world where when they die, they skip over all the mansion worlds and everything, say, okay, now, obviously, those mortals, while they were alive, were able to have mind energy forms that were transcendent of that whole thing where you can't learn the local universe tongue yet on the early mansion worlds. He said, okay, now there might be things of a quite significant nature that would be happening on that world in terms of kindred minds. But even on the mansion worlds, you won't have the ability to be kindred minds until you're, you know, well along in the worlds. You're not going to be kindred minds on the first mansion world.
If a person never heard words, like a deaf person, how would they have thoughts?
Right. See, you know, this is what... You know, what psychologists began to understand as they started to study the mind and think about the mind logically. I mean, when you're born, you know, you aren't born with a language in your head or anything. I mean, so, you know, when a child sees, you know, you, say, you know, they can't put a mom-shaped form in their mind. There aren't any forms in there. There's just... You know, emptiness and chaos initially in that mind. They have no recognition of anything. They don't recognize any objects or anything. They can't make mind forms yet. So that whole process develops. You know, and think about how rudimentary it is when they don't even have all seven adjutants yet in those first several years. They're going to be pretty limited what kind of a mind form they can make. They're not going to be able to make anything very subtle. You know?
Patty Duke, the whole movie. Patty Duke's the Helen Keller.
Yeah.
That's exactly what happened. She had to feel the touch. Couldn't hear, couldn't see.
You know, and again, remember the whole hearing, seeing, tasting, touching, all those senses. Again, those are all in the mind. You know, so initially, a child doesn't see or hear or taste or anything. I mean, there's, you know, sporadic activity going on in the mind, but it's not structured at all yet, you know? So, you know, we think, oh, the child sees me, you know? No, they can't see yet. I mean, they have just a chaos of things going on, you know, that hasn't gotten focused yet at all. I mean, they can barely, just imagine, putting a really thick, lens over their eyes or something, and that's what they, maybe they see very vague, shadowy changes or something. Mm. The things that might have kind of started to develop in the womb, the extent to which the mind has been taught in those first 9 months, but that's obviously very limited. So you have to be taught how to see, taught to hear. None of that is automatic at all. We think of it as mechanical, but it's, no, it's not mechanical. It's deeply mysterious how something goes from jiggling eardrums to something I hear in my mind, and can recognize and interpret and understand. Okay. All right. So let's see here. Did we finish? Let's see. We were on what we did the when assigned to a planet. Yeah, we did that. That was the one we were on, right? Yeah. Let's see. Okay. I think the only thing is just let's kind of get us back in the swing here. Just that thing they were stressing about how the spirit beings are continuously engaged in efforts of self-improvement. That, because that's probably something that's pretty revolutionary relative to the history of thinking about celestial beings. We've never thought about them so literally, where they go to school and these sorts of things. They're reminding you of that just because you're talking about celestial beings, it's not that different from what you understand. They have teachable mind and it has to be taught. Okay.
Cherubim and Sanubim are by nature very near the Marantia level of existence, and they proved to be most efficient in the borderland work of the physical, morontial, and spiritual domains. These children of the local universe mother spirit are characterized by fourth creatures, much as are the Havona servitals and the conciliating commissions. Every fourth cherubim and every fourth sanubim are quasi-material, very definitely resembling the Marantia level of existence.
Okay, it's just so it wasn't confusing. They made a point of saying it specifically that every fourth cherubim and every fourth sanubim. So there's, in a sense, an independent, or a separate, I should say separateness, a separateness of creative act to creating cherubim relative to creating Sanubim. They're not coming in the same stream, if you will. You have this, like we talked about, like they mentioned, back when we were talking about the messenger hosts of space, with the Havona servitals and the conciliating commissions, you have this definitive pattern, fourfold pattern that we recognized a long time ago with basic genetics. That you essentially have a dominant and two dominant recessives and a recessive. Yeah.
Got a question.
Mm-hmm.
What is the actual or potential personality volition of the seraphim, cherubim, and sanubim?
Remember, it's not just talking about them. It's all creatures there. So like we were talking about, take an adjuster, not a person. But it's achieving things over the ages. And when it does fuse with a mortal and then become personalized, that self becomes personalized, all of those achievements will sync right up with what volition can now will upon that self. Now, there won't be a discontinuity, or there won't be, everything you've done before is completely useless. I mean, you get to start from scratch now that I'm volitionally directing this self. That's the point they're trying to make, is that all creatures are in a very continuous process of development, even if they aren't, even if that self isn't personalized for a long time, okay? But the But the issue about the difference between self-assertion and genuine volition is something to spend some time reflecting on. Remember that the personality comes from eternity. It's not a temporal fact, it's an eternity fact. Genuine volition is a direction to bring the self into relationship with infinity and eternity. If what you're thinking about and wanting to call an exercise of your will is temporal, no, that's an assertion of the self. Now, it may be the case that you exercise your will, volition, relative to eternity, and you downstep eternity into a time, and that temporal self asserts itself in time. You know, so that temporal act may be predicated on an eternity exercise of will, on volition, but not necessarily. That's the very disruptive idea of the Lucifer Rebellion. The battle cry is self-assertion. See, unwittingly, that battle cry is, I don't want to be a person anymore. I don't want to be connected to eternity anymore. Well, you'll get your wish eventually. You know, if you want to just be a temporally asserting self, eventually you are granted that. And you are disconnected from eternity, and you will cease to exist at some point. And the only thing that's going to be ongoing is that which is connected to eternity. Right, so that distinction, what's the difference between me as a personal self and me as merely a self? That's never been understood. And so any thought that you've ever had about that is in need of the revelation. There's nothing that any philosopher or any human has ever thought that can help you with understanding that properly. No human has ever understood this. Okay? And so you have to, you know, challenge yourself to stop calling mere self things personality, mere assertion things volition. Okay?
Yeah. Like a baby will cry because it's hungry or it wants something. So that's self-assertion.
Right, it's just, you know, like the one I always use, that, you know, where you really see the assertion, you know, is mom wants to take the kid out of the toy store. Kid does not want to go out of the toy store. Has his feet dug into the pavement, you know, and is resisting being drug out of the store. Right, it's asserting itself. It can very definitively assert itself. But we always have called that the will. Boy, that's a strong-willed kid.
Yeah.
No, it's probably 3 years old and doesn't even have will yet. Okay? Right? And so, you know, most of the time when an adult is doing that, they're not exercising their will. They're just asserting themselves. You know, the energy, the mind energy system can be very directed with no need for spirit energy or personality over controlling it. It can self-direct, right? I mean, your horse doesn't have spirit energy or personality. Can it be quote-unquote strong-willed? We like to say that, see?
Yeah.
But see, technically it's not.
It's
just
itself.
That mind is self-asserting. I mean, mind is a profound thing. It can self-assert, okay? See, it obviously has a closeness to some very profound thing. Yeah, mind is basically synchronized with what the fact of deity. Deity is innately minded. You know, that ability for mind to assert itself, that's an innate deity likeness that it just has. You know, and seeing you had, so you can easily see, exalt that. And think that's personality, or even worse, you know, God. Many humans have so definitively, you know, they've experienced such definitive self-assertion, you know, the mind is asserting itself as an energy system, You know, that they've convinced themselves that only a God could have such definitiveness of direction. Right? Yep.
Can you kind of strike on volition again, please?
Right. So you have will, volition, choice. Okay. Think of that as a progressive sequence. You start with just the potential, will. Okay. If you actualize that potential, if you exercise that will, that's volition. Okay. And that's just a simple, I mean, that's just literally what the word volition means, the exercise of will. So the Revelators aren't, you know, modifying that. But they are trying to get you to really definitively distinguish between volition and will. Don't blur those together like humans tend to a lot of times. Get them really definitively separate. One's a potential and one's an actual. Volition is an actuality. You know, the potential is flowing. It's moving. It's in action. You know, and then if you bring it to a focus, that's a choice. You know, it's like, okay, it's moving. Now what? Well, do something with it. Okay, that's a choice. So will to volition to choice.
But only a personality can make a choice.
Only a person can make a choice. And that's where the, you know, they say you've got two words, decision and choice. Don't blur them together anymore because we need two separate words. So use the word choice just for what a personality can do and use the word decision for what a mind can do. A mind can make decisions. The adjuster is making all kinds of decisions, but it can't make choices. Your soul right now is making all kinds of decisions. Remember, it's minded. It isn't just a blob of Marantia substance. It has Marantia mind seated on it. There's a self there that's making decisions all the time. You're not conscious of those decisions, but it's making decisions. But it can't make choices because personality is not identified with that self. There's only one of the three selves that has personality identified with it, your mortal self. It can make decisions and choices. And it can even make choices which are downstepped into decisions, like we were saying, which is, of course, what you have to do. Mm-hmm. You can't just somehow be up there in the spirit energy. You have to bring it down into the mind. So a choice gets translated down into a decision, if it's anything, you know, literal. But with a, you know, a horse or an adjuster, you know, there is no possibility of taking a choice down to a decision. All it has is decisions. See, but that the fact that that mind can form those decision forms itself, it doesn't have to be told from above, shape yourself like this. You know, like I can have a choice, say, make a decision form like this, and the mind does. But I also can just make a decision form within the mind without any over control like that. It's self-forming as well as being able to be formed from above, to be informed, see, from above. So that, you know, that, you know, the more you think about mind, the more you understand why it's a very profound fact, and it's easy to misinterpret things that are merely mindal, thinking that there's something quite profound. I think, well, they are quite profound, but there's even more profound things. You know, and you need to leave room for them, things that are even more profound than mind and its self-assertion. Okay. All right. Now, meanwhile, back to fourth creatures. Mm-hmm. okay. So, yeah, remember how this worked with the Havona Servitals and conciliating commissions, you know, the conciliators, that you had, you know, that dominant individual, and then two dominant recessive ones, and then a recessive one, where the quote unquote dominant recessive differential is spiritual physical. Remember, you had seven master spirits, seven supreme power directors. You know, so you had that spiritual physical differential between the two parents. You know, spirit dominates mind, mind dominates matter, right? So you have a dominant recessive differential there. You know, and sure enough, it just does like we understand that in genetics. And you get a fourth creature that was quite material-like in both of those cases. Same thing happens here. So you start with your dominant one is going to be, you know, the most spiritual energy like one. And then you're going to have two of them that are half and half. You know, as much spirit energy as physical energy, in a simple way to, you know, just thinking about it simply. And then one that is much more physical, you know, so much more physical-like. It's like, well, okay, but there's only one parent here. Creative Mother Spirit. Oh, that's right. We've seen this before. Material sons and daughters only have one parent. Creator Son. Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, but there's a differential in the Creator Son because you know, that mother nature of the Eternal Mother Son was, you know, recessive in there. Mm-hmm. Okay. Does not a creative mother spirit have a dual nature also? Yes. It's not just one type of deity. There's spirit type deity and mother type deity. Okay? When it's just spirit type deity, when it's just a creative spirit, not yet a creative mother spirit, that entity from, you know, except for the Creator Son, everyone else thinks of it as just an entity, not a person. That entity is doing stuff. What's it doing? Is it doing spiritual stuff? No, it's doing physical stuff. It's basically helping out the power beings, right? Being a downstepped expression of the universal manipulator, the infinite spirit. And it's just, you know, it's very physical, you know, phenomenon. You bring in the mother deity, and now it starts to manifest in a personal way, and personality is spirit pattern. See, so it has a more spirit side to it. Oh, yes, yeah, see, inside of a creative mother spirit is a spiritual, physical differential. So these fourth creatures are going to be more like the spirit part. And there's going to be two that are spirit mother and one that's mother. You know, see, so one that's more spiritual and one that's a little of each. And then these fourth creatures, quasi-material, because they really take after just that energy manipulating fact of a creative spirit. They can much more directly interface with physical energy. Okay? Okay, now just in this case, you notice everything is kind of lifted up a notch. So when they say they're much more physical or material-like, it's not clear down at the level of my corporeal form. You know, it's Marantxa energy-like, but it's obviously going to be Marantxa energy that's very much on the material side of the blend of the spiritual and physical fibers of Marantxa substance. You know, quite material like Marantxa energy bodies that those cherubim have. Okay, and they get that from the spirit part of their parent as opposed to the mother side. All right, let's see. I think, yeah, let's go ahead here.
These angelic fourth creatures are of great assistance to the seraphim in the more literal phases of their universe and planetary activities. Such Marantxa cherubim also perform many indispensable borderline tasks on the Marantxa training worlds and are assigned to the service of the Marantxa companions in large numbers. They are to the Marantxa spheres about what the midway creatures are to the evolutionary planets. On the inhabited worlds, these Marantxa cherubim frequently work in liaison with the midway creatures. Cherubim and midway creatures are distinctly separate orders of beings. They have dissimilar origins, but they disclose great similarity in nature and function.
Right, so again, you just think about sort of a subtext there about the unrevealed order of angels. You know, how you could make a sentence like that relative to them. You know, like I said, you know, think of the midwayers and the angels as two parallel vertical hierarchies. You know, the angels are a very tall hierarchy. They go all the way up to, you know, the midway creatures, you know, are just down at the lower part, at least what we know. You know, and maybe that is quite still the case. You know, you could wonder, the closer the grand universe gets to being settled in light and life, is that side of the parallel going to start to fill out? You know, and more, there'll be a more and more of a vertical, you know, where even quite high angels, you know, will have a parallel that's welling up out of the supreme. Because remember, that's the difference. You have one where it's reaching down from the infinite spirit, and the other one, you know, basically it's the paradise trinity, you know, through the supreme welling up, you know, and making these two parallel tracks of a hierarchy of beings. Okay, let's see. So you notice that they work with the Mirage companions, etc. So, like they're saying, it's, you know, if you need a very literal Mirage thing done, you have a Mirage cherubim do it, because they can just like very directly interface with the substance. You know, as opposed, you know, in its wholeness, as opposed to just engaging the spirit aspect of the Mirage substance. Say, you know, they can engage the material part of the Mirage substance just as literally as the spirit part of the Mirage substance. So like we said, if this cup needs to be moved, you know, you have, say, a secondary midwayer come in and grab a hold of this cup and move it, because they can literally engage it as a material cup and move it, whereas a higher being can't. So the same way, just take it all up a notch to Mirage substance. And obviously, when you're at the very low levels of Mirage substance, you're going to need beings that can, you know, engage it mostly as a material fact, because there's not that much spirit energy in it. Right? Is there a question somewhere?
Don did. You had one, didn't you?
No? You okay? All right. Let's see. Anything else in there? You obviously, as they're saying, you know, these borderline tasks, you know, there's all these interfaces when you have to bridge the gap between material substance and Mirage substance, or the gap between Mirage substance and spirit substance. You're going to need beings that are always able to have one foot on each side of the line, you know, in some way, and to be able to, you know, take things back and forth across that borderline.
So is the Mirage cherubim different than the other cherubim?
Yeah, as you're going to see here in the next section, yeah. So we have these four, you know, definite different types. Yeah.
Question is, any significance to the last paragraph only mentioning cherubim and nothing about Sanabim?
Yeah, again, there, see, cherubim in the general sense. So when they say cherubim and midway creatures, or cherubim frequently, they mean cherubim and Sanabim. They're using cherubim as a general term there. Yeah, like I said, you just have to always, you know, it'll get really laborious if every single time, you know, they said both of them, you know. Yeah. Right. All right, let's see. Is there anything? I think we, let's see. I think that's everything there. Let's keep going here.
Number 8, evolution of cherubim and Sanabim. Numerous avenues of advancing service are open to cherubim and Sanabim, leading to an enhancement of status, which may be still further augmented by the embrace of the divine minister. There are 3 great classes of cherubim and Sanabim with regard to evolutionary potential.
Okay, so before you read those, you see there's going to be these 4 different types, like we said, a dominant-dominant, a dominant-recessive, and a recessive-recessive, in that order. You know, I should, you know, 3 types, but 4 creatures involved in getting you all 3 types. You notice that they slipped in right away at the beginning. They're upgradable. Okay. So, you know, some of them especially, can be embraced by the Creative Mother Spirit and taken up a notch, and we've talked about this a lot. She has the ability to do this with a lot of beings. You know, they'll give them an upgrade. So, like, say, they can be plugged into mind at a higher level or whatever. Yep. So you have upgradable creatures, and as we see with the first ones, you know, that's very significant, that upgradability.
Number 1, ascension candidates. These beings are by nature candidates for seraphic status. Cherubim and Sanabim of this order are brilliant, though not by inherent endowment equal to the seraphim, but by application and experience, it is possible for them to attain full seraphic standing.
And so they're going to explain that in detail, you know, in a little bit here. But and so now you have some that are really close to being seraphim to begin with. And, you know, like they're saying, through a lot of experiential acquirement and then some, you know, getting new operating systems, they can be taken up and are literally seraphim then. You know, they're not, you know, like seraphim. They literally are seraphim then. You know, see, so that reminds you, like I said, I mean, think of cherubim as a downstep seraphim, because here you're, you know, just going the other direction. You're moving them back up again, and they aren't glorified cherubim. They are literally seraphim.
Yeah. Now, again, they can also be upgraded by education.
Yeah, like I said, there's two things that upgrade. You know, the acquirement that they get in relationship to experiential deity, you know, adds to their nature, like an adjuster, for instance, is getting constantly upgraded because it's acquiring more nature relative to experiential deity. Yeah, but then there's also this, you know, it's like, okay, you've done everything you can do in terms of an evolutionary phenomenon. Now let me embrace you and put the finishing touches on it. Okay, now you're basically a new creature. Okay, so it's just like the way it works. You know, you have biologic evolution, does everything it can do in and of itself, and then Adam and Eve come in and give it an upgrade. That's it's the same thing here. No, they will. I mean, you know, especially when they, you know, and you get them to be seraphim. Remember, the higher you go, the more seraphim and mortals, you know, are a emerging phenomenon to the point where they can be in the mortal core of the finality with you, right? Yeah, so.
2, mid-phase cherubim. All cherubim and sanubim are not equal in ascension potential. And these are the inherently limited beings of the angelic creations. Most of them will remain cherubim and sanubim, although the more gifted individuals may achieve limited seraphic service.
Okay, so basically, you know, if we're making 4 of them, you got the 2 in the middle. They're pretty much the ones that are staying, you know, at the local universe level. You know, I mean, it, you know, but apparently, you know, it's a bell curve sort of a thing. And there are some that are almost like ascension candidate ones. You know, so they can start to be a little bit more seraphim-like, but not fully. You know, and then there's going to be some that are going to be, you know, clear down and close to the next group of the Maranja cherubim, obviously, too, on that bell curve. Yep. Right. See, that's what I was saying, that you can be kind of suspicious that things like the local universe tongue maybe are sort of just there, you know, you don't have to really teach that mind much. They're quite brilliant just by nature.
Are you talking intellectual?
Yeah. Yeah, we're talking intellectual, yeah. Right, remember, and that's one of the first things they do at the beginning of the foreword, you know, in the beginning of the book, in the foreword is, you know, tell you that, you know, your idea of using the light designation for intellect is not just metaphoric, that it's literal, right? Yeah, yeah, right, yeah. Because again, they're trying to get you to, you know, right at the very beginning, they're trying to get you to think literally. You know, mind is not a concept. It's a literal energy, just as literal as the arm of this chair. Okay? You know, and so is spirit substance. You know, they're literal and they have all kinds of parallels of physics to them, like physical energy does. Very, very literal. And again, that's not exactly... There's not a lot of pedigree to that idea in human history, right? That's a pretty revolutionary idea to think of, you know, of mind and spirit as literal energies, you know, like I was describing it, you know, if I'm going to have the word cat in my head, you know, if I could see mind energy, there would be a particular shape in it, okay? It's like molding clay, only don't think of it as so static. You got to make it all dynamic, but you get the analogy. All right.
3, Maranja cherubim. These fourth creatures of the angelic orders always retain their quasi-material characteristics. They will continue on as cherubim and sanubim together with the majority of their mid-phase brethren, pending the completed factualization of the Supreme Being.
All right, so by and large, like we said earlier, see, until the grand universe is settled in light and life, you know, the mid-phase cherubim and the Mirage cherubim definitely are just part of the local universe system all the way to the end. Okay. Let's keep going here.
While the second and third groups are somewhat limited in growth potential, the ascension candidates may attain the heights of universal seraphic service. Many of the more experienced of these cherubim are attached to the seraphic guardians of destiny and are thus placed in direct line for advancement to the status of mansion world teachers when deserted by their seraphic seniors. Guardians of destiny do not have cherubim and sanubim as helpers when their mortal wards attain the Mirage life. And when other types of evolutionary seraphim are granted clearance for seraphington and paradise, they must forsake their former subordinates when they pass out of the confines of Nevadon. Such deserted cherubim and sanubim are usually embraced by the universe mother spirit, thus achieving a level equivalent to that of a mansion world teacher in the attainment of seraphic status.
Wow. Okay, so in either way, either because you literally have someone who's third circler, and has a pair of seraphim and a pair of cherubim, that are going with them. Well, when you go up, when you're resurrected on the first mansion world, you don't need that pair of cherubim anymore, right? Okay. Or, like they're saying, also, if you've got, nothing to do with ascending mortals, but just seraphim doing whatever, and they're slated to, go up and work at a higher level, their assistants are left behind. Right? So in either case, the creative mother spirit envelops them and takes their energy system up a notch, gives them an upgraded energy system, an upgraded self, same personality, but an upgraded self, just like us. We're resurrected in the first mansion world, we have an upgraded self, same personality, identifies with it. So all of that rekeying, you do all the way up through the local universe. This is just an example, singular example of them being rekeyed, quote unquote. And so you go up to this level that you remember in a few papers down the road here, we'll read about mansion world teachers. So those are these upgraded cherubim. There's a question?
Question of whether ascension mortal candidates also have limited ascension potential in this modern mind of man in our day and age today be similar to the evolution of cherubim and sanubim?
You can see how, you've heard me kind of say basically that a number of times, that because of the default, we all have to be very humbly, honest about our nature. There's a limit to how much you can do with this, the kind of self that you can seed on this kind of a energy system. It's a not very upgraded energy system that we all are using here. So, in many ways, we very much need that higher self that you get when you go to the first mansion world so that you can start, moving forward in earnest. We're all going to come up against some really harsh limits in this life, or it doesn't matter how much we want to go further, we can. Now, if you pick the right genetics and it's well nurtured, it can go all the way to fusion. Jesus demonstrated that. But I don't think, Gabriel came down and made sure that my genetics was you know, up to the task of me getting to be a first circler, let alone fusing. You know, it may be just impossible for me, you know, with the kind of genetics I have. I may not even be able to get remotely close to that, you know, let alone all of the nurturing issues, you know, that all of us can have that also can severely limit your ability to get very far in this life. You know, and once your mind is taught by your genetics and your environment, and it starts to kind of solidify as you get biologically older, you know, that's kind of just where you are. You know, you got to wait for the upgrade if you're going to get much further, you know, in your personality development. Yeah.
When they advance, do they do so as a pair or individually?
All right, so you know, remember that seraphim definitely have pairs. So they're initially going to be very much having to do it as a pair. You know, and I would think they'd go all the way up to seraphim in that same pair. But once they actually get all the way up to a full seraphim, okay, now they can start to have some independence. I would think there's, you know, they could even possibly repair or things like that. You remember we talked about that. Seraphim, you know, can repair and saying they aren't, you know, but initially these cherubim and seraphim, I mean, there's, you know, they're a pair and that's just it. Okay. So, you know, there's going to be an evolution of that. The higher they get, the more they could start to be separate from each other. But, you know, the whole issue of how this works, you know, what if one of the pair joins a rebellion? You know, I mean, is it ever the case that that can happen? I mean, they're so connected. They may always join rebellions in pairs. I don't know.
I would think they would.
But, yeah, I mean, it's your first suspicion. But, you know. If somehow they can do it separately, you know, I'm sure the Greater Mother Spirit, you know, has a way of dealing with that. But
why do they say deserted? Why do they use that word?
Just literally, they're left behind. I mean, right, and they wanted to invoke the emotion of that. Why do they want to invoke the emotion? Not for our sake. They want you to know how the cherubim feels. The cherubim has emotions a lot like we do. The cherubim will feel deserted. Yeah. Now they'll try to be very objective about it, but they will still feel the loss very, very deeply.
But they also get upgraded.
Now, obviously, the more they get upgraded, the more they have the objective perspective to overcome that. But again, see, they purposely use that word because they're not that objective by nature. They're down there in the trenches. They're going to be easily, you know, suckered into rebellions and whatnot, right? Right. So they're going to feel a very distinct loss. That's why they use that word deserted. So you feel a pang in your gut when you read it.
Well, that's why I thought it's kind of sad.
You know, right. They want you to feel sad.
I wonder, I mean, can they communicate as the seraphim move on?
Well, obviously, yeah. I mean, yeah, right. But, you know, is it totally equivalent to talk to your best friend on the phone as to, you know, talk to him in person? You know, and remember, I mean, they may never see those seraphim in person again. It's a big, grand universe. You know, they may talk to them on the phone, quote unquote, you know, for trillions of years, but they may never see them in person again. You know, they're standing there on the line knowing they, you know, if they step over the line, they come and plugged, you know, and their seraphim step over the line and off they go and become a point in the distance and they may never see them again.
Wow.
Right? So it's like the ship fading, you know, on the horizon as it heads to the new world.
Don't make it worse, Chris.
Right? Yep.
Question from somebody else. Mm-hmm. What do they look like?
Well, again, you know, we can't say exactly what they look like. All you know is it's our body form is a downstep expression of that on high. So, in some way they are like us. You know, and the closer they get to us, you know, we're talking here, the more I think you can think of them very much as just, if you could see one, it would be, it'd have two legs, two arms, you know, a torso, a head, you know, it'd be just like you. I mean, you know, you take it all the way down to a secondary midware and you turn this knob where now you see me, now you don't, you know, and if you can see them, they look just like you. Mm. And if you can't see them, yeah. Right, so they're going to be very much like you. And I, you know, remember we reminded when we were talking about Melchizedek's, you know, literally a Melchizedek can make himself look like me, you know, look like a material being. You know, and he's not doing that by, he starts out as a sphere, you know, and then he morphs into something with legs and, you know, no. He's like that to begin with. He's a being.
That's why he
they walk around. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I mean, obviously there's going to be some differences. But in general, you know, we are made, you know, in the image of those on high. We're a downstepped expression in some way. So
when he appeared, then that's the way he looked on high, and then he made him, he just...
No, with Machiavelli, remember, he was incarnated. That was different.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so that was different. They had a, you know, they built a body for him. Okay. Yeah, so that was different. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Machiavelli, when he incarnated as Machiavelli, he would have been a sex creature.
Yes.
Yeah,
just like Jesus was a sex creature.
Well, I knew that.
Right? See, again, you know, I mean, they're made literal. I mean, and the reason that's, you know, I mean, it's important to appreciate that that's the significance of an incarnation for Melchizedek. I mean, they literally have the full material body with the kind of adjutant mind that seats on that. You know, I mean, if you don't have X and Y chromosomes, you know, you don't have the proper mind forms and the mind energy system. I mean, all of this is a package deal, right? So, I don't see any reason why he wouldn't have been, you know, literally a procreating being, and didn't, just like with Jesus. Yep.
Grandma and grandpa.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see here. Anything else in there? Let's see. No, I think we covered everything here. Go ahead.
When as Imagine World teachers, the once embraced Cherubim and Sanubim have long served on the Meranchi spheres, from the lowest to the highest. And when their course on Salvington is over-recruited, the bright morning star summons these faithful servants of the creatures of time to appear in his presence. The oath of personality transformation is administered, and thereupon, in groups of 7,000, these advanced and senior cherubim and sanubim are re-embraced by the universe mother spirit. From this second embrace, they emerge as full-fledged seraphim. Henceforth, the full and complete career of a seraphim, with all of its paradise possibilities, is open to such reborn cherubim and sanubim. Such angels may be assigned as guardians of destiny to some mortal being. And if the mortal ward attains survival, then do they become eligible for advancement to Seraphington and the seven circles of seraphic attainment, even to paradise in the core of the finality. Wow.
Right, see, so all the way, everything they've revealed about what seraphim can do, they're identical. They are literally seraphim after that second upgrade. Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's really cool.
Right, and so, I mean, your guardian angels may have been maybe former cherubim. We don't know. But they're not cherubim anymore. Yeah, you know, they are literally seraphim, just like any other seraphim now.
I like the fact that they allow everything to evolve. You know.
Yeah. Right. Right. There's very few. You know, as we've read, you know, there's very few in terms of what's been revealed to us beings that are not part of the evolutionary process. you know, that are sort of just part of the framework, you know, that holds the evolutionary regime together. Most of them are part of the process, to some degree anyway. Okay, now just in the middle there, the oath of personality transformation. So they're no longer the same personality afterwards? See, again, no, that would be a misinterpretation. Right? It's the exact same personality identifying with the self. The self has been modified. Same personality is still identified to it. Right? So a lot of times, see, they mean, you know, the oath of personalized self transformation, you know, it's the self literally that's being transformed. That energy system is being modified. And of course, to modify the mindal energy system that's the self, it means you're modifying the body that mind is seated on, right? So, I mean, they're just getting what literally is happening is they're modifying the body of that being, and then mind, you know, adapts to that modified body, and now they have an upgraded self. Okay, so Gabriel is involved in that process. And you see how this works with the Imagine World teachers, you know, if you didn't pick up on that. See, they start at the bottom and they work their way up to the top and they start accumulating in a big pool on Salvington. And it's like, okay, the pool is getting too big here. And so it takes a chunk. It's time for you guys to go through the process here. Yeah.
Can't change the zoning laws.
Got another question.
Yep.
If we are made in the form of the Most Highs, what about the other different forms on other planets?
Again, you know, think about, you know, just take all of the planets in our local system. Okay, 619 of them, and you could mate with any of them. I mean, because Adam and Eve can mate with, you know, you take a material son and daughter from Gerasim, you can send them to any of those 619 worlds. Okay, we're that similar. You know, that you literally could mate with them. Okay. Now, you know, you're probably not biologically compatible with someone from a neighboring system. You know, every indication is, you know, that's why you have separate atom, you know, separate material sons and daughters for each, you know, local system. But still, the variations are not huge. You know, if you walk up to a mortal from, you know, a planet in, you know, and I mean, even in a different local universe, you know, you're going to recognize them as a mortal. They're going to be bipedal and carbon-based, you know, body and everything just like you.
Won't be able to talk to them.
Yeah, yeah. Right, you won't know their language, right? But, yeah. let's see, anything else in there? No, I think that's it. Let's get some midway creatures here.
Number 9, the midway creatures. The midway creatures have a threefold classification. They are properly classified with the ascending sons of God. They are factually grouped with the orders of permanent citizenship, while they are functionally reckoned with the ministering spirits of time because of their intimate and effective association with the angelic host in the work of serving mortal man on the individual worlds of space.
Okay, so there's a reason why you find stuff about the midway creatures in different spots in the book. And it's because of what they're just saying there. So the stuff that's sort of immediately fits into them acting kind of like ministering spirits, you know, they're saying right here, you know, we just read about them as permanent citizens, you know, in the previous paper. So, you know, we all know there's a whole bunch in paper 77 about the midway creatures. You know, it was just kind of more in the line of them beginning as ascending sons. That contrast between ascending sons and permanent citizens, remember that basically they're permanent citizens until a planet gets settled in light and life, and then they can start to be transformed and start to ascend. I mean, they need to be modified so they can get an adjuster and, you know, these sorts of things. But some of them may stay literally all the way into like seven stages of light and life. Not a lot, but you know, there may be a handful left. You know, so they can be on that planet for a really, really long time before they actually start to ascend. Let's see. But you notice, you know, that they are properly classified. Okay, so I'm reading a section here about an improper classification. Right? What's this? You know, if this section was proper, what would this section be about? The lower order of angels is not revealed. That's the proper section here. Right? They're telling you right there that this is improper. Yeah. All right.
I don't get that.
But just, I mean, they aren't literally ministering spirits.
The midway creatures.
The midway creatures. You know, they aren't literally. They're effectively, like they're saying, you know, they're functionally reckoned with the ministering spirits of time because of their intimate and effective association with the angelic host, etc. Okay, but they aren't literally ministering spirits, just effectively. Right, so it's not the proper classification of them to put them in section 9 of paper 38. Yeah, properly, the lower order of angels should be section 9 of paper 38, right? Okay.
These unique creatures appear on the majority of the inhabited worlds and are always found on the decimal or life experiment planets, such as Urantia. Midwayers are of two types, primary and secondary, and they appear by the following techniques.
Okay, the one little thing there, you know, they don't explain. But it's curious, you know, they're not on all planets. They're always on decimal worlds, but not on every planet. They appear on the majority of inhabited worlds. And I think, well, okay, they're probably not on a Midsonider world. Maybe they're not on non-breather worlds. You know, you think about it, you know, we wondered, you know, there's probably a number of things that are different about the whole planetary supervision and stuff of a non-breather world. You know, maybe that's another, you know, you're just left to speculate. So I'm just kind of tossing that out there to get the juices flowing. You know, just notice little things like that. They, you know, they appear on the majority, not all.
Yep. Then what form are the other life forms made in the likeness of, such as ELEC?
Well, I mean, again, I mean, in terms of, I mean, all life forms are made in the image of God, quote unquote. It's just that when you downstep an infinite being down to our level, infinity has consequences. That one likeness is not, or the likeness of God is not singular. Let's say it that way. You know, it's many. I mean, just think about what happens when you downstep a literal creator. You know, is there just one creator son? No. The more you downstep, the more, you know, multitudinous it becomes. And are all creator sons identical? No, not even remotely. Okay. So, you know. Right, there's all these things about all the different types of more, you know, we'll be getting to ascending suns eventually here and stuff. And, right, there's all these different types of mortals. But, you know, I could be shaped just like I am and be a three-brain type or a one-brain type. You know, so, you know, again, there's going to be all, you know, I mean, the plasticity of skin is not going to be identical for every mortal. It's obviously going to have all kinds of variation. You know, not to mention if you poked a non-breather, his skin is not going to feel anything like yours because he doesn't have any water in his body. Okay? Right? So, I mean, there's all kinds of variations, but non-breathers still have two legs, two arms, you know, et cetera, two eyes. Right? I mean, there's a basic form.
Probably when they say that, you know, man is made in God's image, they probably mean more of the personality, not the physical.
Well, I mean, most immediate, I actually referred to it early on. I mean, every one of our personalities is absolutely unique, so it's not in the image of anything. I mean, it just literally is a personality. But our self, you know, we have all these different mindful selves. And, you know, what did I was saying about, when I was talking about those mindful selves, what are they immediately a downstepped expression of? Deity. Right? I mean, you have deity on high, and if it's personalized, it's God. If you downstep deity, you have selves, and they're personalized as creatures. Right? I mean, you're in the image of the deity downstepped. So it's not literally deity anymore, but it's minded and has self-assertion, just like deity is innately minded, like we were just talking about. I mean, that's fundamentally, you know, your likeness. Yeah? Yeah. I mean, you can't make your personality like anything else. Oh. It's absolutely unique. Okay? But yourself can be more and more deity-like. When yourself is fully deity-like, what do you call that self? Divine. That's what divinity is, deity likeness. Right? And see, that's the thing about, see, when you have deity revealed in the revelation, you now actually can think literally about what that's about, that description that you're made in the image of God. You can't understand that if you're thinking about personality and God, you know. No, it's the deity part.
And we always think of the anthropomorphic God.
Right. Exactly. So that's, you know, that's what you're trying to, you know, get to appreciate more. You know, the more you
think about it other than that. Mm. How can we think of God without making him look like us?
Yeah, well, until the fifth epical revelation, that's why God was always anthropomorphic. Because like you say, I mean, what else are you gonna do? You know? But now with the revelation, you can actually, instead of having to try to, you know, lift your thoughts up and turn them into something that's worthy of being called God, you know, you're actually revealed what God is. And then you can start to appreciate how, if I downstep that, I get me. You know, I am a downstepped expression of God rather than God is an upstepped expression of me. Right. Right. Okay, let's get into the...
Okay. One, primary midwares, the more spiritual group, are a somewhat standardized order of beings who are uniformly derived from the modified ascendant mortal staffs of the planetary princes. The number of primary midway creatures is always 50,000, and no planet enjoying their ministry has a larger group.
Okay, so remember how this works. Midway creatures are really a manifestation of the Paradise Trinity through the Supreme into time. You know, you can think of them as a phenomenon that's coalescing out of the evolutionary whole of the grand universe. They're bubbling up from the bottom, if you will. You know, and are, you know, they appear to be the offspring of, say, the prince's staff and whatnot. But, you know, the very fact that the prince's staff can do what they need to do to make a primary midwayer, and it works, and it works, and it works, and then they get to try to do it 50,001 times, and nope. Oh, so maybe it's not, maybe not really my children. Maybe I'm being used as a conduit, you know, to bring these beings into existence. Yes, that's exactly what's going on. Right. Midway creatures are an expression of the Trinity, and, you know, and the Mother, you know, and the Supreme. Manifesting as creatures in time. And so, no matter what, you get exactly 50,000. You know, and remember, you always have 50 couples in the prince's staff, right? So, you know, what you actually have is each couple makes exactly 1,000 of them. And then that's it. So you have this interesting, see, thousandfold. See, that's what you can start to, it's like, so there's some thousandfold pattern that's being manifested from the Supreme through these procreators. Yeah, but to think of them as not so much procreating for the existential creators, but more procreating for the experiential creators. Right? You know, and they, you know, when we procreate, they call them, you know, children of the Father. Okay, see, so in other words, they're saying our procreation is really coming down from the existential creators. The midwayers are different. This is a procreation that's really an indirect creation of the experiential creators. Okay. All right, and so the, you know, the much more spirit-like ones, the primary midwayers, there's always 50,000 of them, if there is them, you know, if there are midwayers at all. Okay.
Two secondary midwayers, the more material group of these creatures, vary greatly in numbers on the different worlds, though the average is around 50,000. They are variously derived from the planetary biologic uplifters, the Adams and Eves, or from their immediate progeny. There are no less than 24 diverse techniques involved in the production of these secondary midway creatures on the evolutionary worlds of space. The mode of origin for this group on Urantia was unusual and extraordinary.
But not unique, you notice. Okay. As convoluted as that is, you know, where, you know, the first son of Adam and Eve finds, you know, the last pure remaining Nodite female and all that rigmarole, you know, it apparently quite similar things have happened before. Okay, and you notice, you know, so you have in the average, you have this same thing where you get 50,000 through a very, you know, different method, but it's only on the average. Okay, and how many did we get through Adamson and Rada? You know, well, the 16 progenitors. Anyone remember our total number of secondary midwayers?
Oh, 11.
No, that's the remaining ones. How many were there before the rebellion? 1,984? 1984 won't be like 1984. You can remember that. It's a famous number. All right, so the average is around 50,000, and we got only 1,984 of them. Okay, so that's that shows you that our plan. Well, they're about to say, no, you get exactly the number that you need. They're not spread thin with 1984. Okay, you know, if we have less than 1984, they're spread thin. Yes. Okay. But see, that's trying to tell you something very definitive. So our planet is such, and the Supreme knows this. So coincidentally, through this indirect procreation action, the Supreme gives us exactly the number that we need, and we don't need very many. So you could start to speculate, well, why don't we need very many? See, and that's, so you start to think, well, what do they normally do? And why wouldn't we normally, you know, why wouldn't we need that normal doing? See, that's what they want you to start thinking about. You know, whereas some, maybe there's some worlds that get, you know, 150,000 of them. You know, and then you can say, well, what's wrong with them? You know, why do they need so much help? Or whatever, right? They're wanting you to think about this spectrum and what it implies. Let's see here. What else do we have? It is kind of curious. There's no less than 24. Now, 24 is obviously not a very random number. they're probably, you know, they've been counting them, and they're like, well, you know, I'm wondering if there's, you know, if there's some sort of a 12 thing going on here, and so far we've got 2 times 12, and maybe by the time the grand universe is settled in light and life, we'll have some exact multiple of 12 or something of all the different ways they've come into existence. They're looking for patterns, see, is what they're trying to point out. And they're already suspicious that it's a multiple of 12 that's going on here. Okay? Because especially the secondaries are very, very mysterious phenomenon. So everyone is doing research on this, trying to figure out what the Supreme is up to. Okay.
Neither of these groups is an evolutionary accident. Both are essential features in the predetermined plans of the universe architects, and their appearance on the evolving worlds at the opportune juncture is in accordance with the original designs and developmental plans of the supervising life carriers.
Okay, so they give you some details. So the master architects, they know, have this all in mind, you know, and it's happening through the Supreme, through the Trinity and the Supreme, in a more literal, you know, sense. But it's obviously going to be all part of the master architect's grand plan. And the life carriers, even though they have no idea in advance, they designed us so that one way or another, when the Supreme finally puts the circumstances together, the potential is there for midwayers to come out. So in other words, they could design life where the Supreme couldn't manifest through the phenomenon if they did it improperly. Remember, we've talked about this. Roughly every 10 worlds is a decimal experimental world because they need to test exactly where the Supreme is. So they don't improperly design it and short circuit this process. You know, so they've got to know what the Supreme is up to so they can make it so that the potential is there. And then they're always fascinated one way or another. Sure enough, it comes out. You know, but it couldn't have if they hadn't allowed for it in their design. See, so that's a really direct example of why you have decimal worlds. So that you allow for the eventual manifestation of secondary midwares. Your question?
Yes. when you can derive this comfort level to the revelators, making it okay for 1984, why would we not assume that the Supreme could not produce more later of secondary midwares?
Well, you know, it appears that it's, you know, in both cases, it's a one-off phenomenon. The potential is there, and then it's no longer there. Like in our case, Adamson was long-lived, but not immortal. Eventually, he died. You know, and once all the first generation, think of it, there was no default. You know, it appeared it required a first generation, child of Adam and Eve to do this. Eventually, all those first generation would be dead, and then there's no way that this could happen. Well, they're no longer reproducing. They're not on Salvation. They're on Indentia. Remember, they're no longer reproducing because of the transport. Dematerialize, rematerialize, they're not reproducing anymore. Anyway, there's all these, they have to very carefully design this in to make it possible. So, like I was saying, there's few things you can point to that so directly are related to the why you have decimal worlds, that you're trying to keep synced up with the Supreme, like you've heard me say so many times, then that little statement right there. Okay.
Primary midwayers are energized intellectually and spiritually by the angelic technique and are uniform in intellectual status. The seven adjutant mind spirits make no contact with them. And only the sixth and the seventh, the spirit of worship and the spirit of wisdom, are able to minister to the secondary group.
Read the next one too.
Secondary midwayers are physically energized by the Adamic technique, spiritually encircled by the Seraphic, and intellectually endowed with the Marantia transition type of mind. They are divided into four physical types, seven orders spiritually, and 12 levels of intellectual response to the joint ministry of the last two adjutant spirits and the Marantia mind. These diversities determine their differential of activity and of planetary assignment.
Okay, so with the primaries, their selves are very similar. Their mindal selves are very similar. And they are both minded, and their spirit encirclement is basically the way all the angels are minded and spiritually encircled. Okay? But with the secondary midwayers, it's very complicated and very different. So they have a vast diversity of mindal selves. All of this complexity. They, you know, so to start with, in terms of how they're encircled spiritually, you've got seven orders. So obviously this must be the, you know, like the seven master spirit, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. This must be the sevenfold individuation of spirit unity. So in that way, you know, the fact we have all seven types of reflective spirits in our super universe, you're seeing them encompassing that full seven. Or again, you know, like I say, who's behind this procreation? The Supreme, which is encompasses all seven super universes. See, so you're seeing that coming through here. So there, you have seven different ceiling types, you know, how, you know, what's the spiritual encirclement at the ceiling of their mind. But then down in the mind, you have 12 different flavors of mind, because you have four physical foundations that mind's going to seed on, four different types of physical foundations that mind's going to seed on. And you have this three-phase mind. You know, we have a seven-phase mind, you know, with the seven adjutants. They have a three-phase mind, sixth and seventh adjutants, and Marantia mind. So you take, you know, physical type number one, it could have a bias towards the sixth adjutant, could have a bias towards the seventh adjutant, or could have a bias towards the Marantia mind. Okay, there's three different intellectual types there. You know, take physical type number two. Again, 1, 2, 3. See, so you have 4 times 3, you have 12 different types. Because, you know, just like a Sangic is biased towards one of the six adjutants, see, they're telling you you've got a midwayer that has a bias towards the sixth or a bias towards the Marantia, and seated on four different flavors of physical foundation. Okay, so that's how you get to 12. And it's 4 times 3 there. All right, and the secondary ones are physically energized by the Adamic technique. So in other words, they have that highest mechanical mind energization, the kind that makes Adams and Eves glow. Okay, they've got that high level of mechanical mind that's associated with their bodies. So at the same time that they have mechanical mind, even though it's the highest type of mechanical mind, they're spiritually encircled by the seraphic technique. So these beings span, you know, the whole spectrum internally. Very fascinating beings. You know, just to have adjutant mind and Marantia mind together, rather interesting. You know, it's nothing you're ever going to have. All right, so secondary midwayers are a very fascinating synthesis being. Member of the Supreme, the power personality synthesis. Look at what a fascinating synthesis these beings are of the various diverse things that are going on. Things that normally are not, you know, in the same being at the same time at all are in these beings. No, okay. Secondary midwayers, very intriguing beings. Let's see, anything else in there? Other than the fact that, you know, you go, well, wait a minute, I thought you had to have a Marantia body to have Marantia mind seated on it. Well, you see, well, they must have something that's Marantia-like, apparently, really. It's like, well, how could they get something that's kind of like a weave of physical and spirit, you know, energy? Well, let's see, I think about how they come into existence when I read about that. You know, is it like the primaries where it's just a non-sex liaison that gives rise to them? No. No, it's both non-sex and sex liaison. It's like the spiritual and the material woven together. Those two liaisons are woven together. No wonder you can seat Marantia mind on them. See, so there's all kinds of things you can put together about that. But you don't get to that until, I think that's a paper 77 where they, you know, or, no, well, yeah, I think it's there. I think it's there that they tell you that.
Am I just confused that I thought the sex and non-sex were the primaries and the secondaries, where they just mated the male and the female children?
No, the primaries, they were engaged in physical sex, but it wasn't actually part of the, remember, it's, You know, it tells you that, you know, that it was, that wasn't literally part of bringing them into existence. They were engaged in sex, but that was just a corollary phenomenon to what, you know, that it was the non-sex liaison. Yeah, supposedly, you know, non-sex, because it, you know, because they were engaged in sex, but it wasn't literally part of the production of the midware. Mm. You know, they tell you, you know, that it was the overlapping of their Marantia energy systems that gave that super additive consequence. But for the secondaries, it's the overlapping of the physical and the Marantia, you know, the sort of spiritual or whatever. I mean, it's giving rise to it.
Weren't these the primaries? Aren't they the ones that are invisible?
They're all invisible, I mean, basically. I mean, the primaries are coming from the prince's staff.
Yeah, but yeah. So how did they see them if they were invisible?
The prince's staff can see them.
And they're the
remember, Adam and Eve, for instance, can see all the lower beings and stuff. You know, it's only us that can't see them.
They can see invisible things.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. Because they're not invisible to them. They can't see invisible things. That's illogical.
That's what
but they can see. They can see things that are invisible to us.
So when they say invisible, it's only invisible.
Invisible to us, yeah. Not literally invisible. That would be impossible. Right. They can see things that aren't there. Yeah, so can crazy people. That's not what we're talking about. Okay, let's get some more here.
Okay. Secondary.
No, primary.
Oh,
primary,
down
yeah.
here, the third. Primary midwares resemble angels more than mortals. The secondary orders are much more like human beings. Each renders invaluable assistance to the other in the execution of their manifold planetary assignments. The primary ministers can achieve liaison cooperation with both Marantia and spirit energy controllers and mind circuitors. The secondary group can establish working connections only with the physical controllers and the material circuit manipulators. But since each order of midware can establish perfect synchrony of contact with the other, either group is thereby able to achieve practical utilization of the entire energy gamut, extending from the gross physical power of the material worlds up through the transition phases of universe energies to the higher spirit reality forces of the celestial realms.
Okay, that's all, you know, straightforward, pretty straightforward. But just, I mentioned this. So the primaries see Marantia and spirit energy, you know, and their controllers, and you know, that mind circuiters, you know, remember, we were saying when they make the communication channels in the universe, you know, they basically lay out a physical energy plate, you know, as it were, and a spirit energy plate, and then they have a conduit, you know, of mind energy between those two plates, quote unquote. Right, so mind circuiters, literal mind energy, conduits for communication channels. And, you know, you see again the secondaries have this closeness with the power beings, you know, like we've talked about. You know, the fact that secondary midwares can actually do some of that power being kind of stuff, manipulate physical things without, you know, having to literally touch them with hands and push them like we have to. Right. So they've got, because of that nature, they're obviously naturally synchronized with the power beings. But see, they're giving you take the energy up above the material, and the primaries are synchronized with power beings too. They're all power personality synthesis type beings, see, just at different levels. So again, see, that's a reminder of who's behind this procreation. It's the power personality synthesis. It's the supreme being that's, you know, outside of time, behind all of this phenomenon. You're seeing these beings that are in the supreme being's image. See. Little power personality synthesis type beings at various levels. Okay.
The gap between the material and spiritual worlds is perfectly bridged by the serial association of mortal man. secondary midware, primary midware, Marantia cherubim, mid-phase cherubim, and seraphim. In the personal experience of an individual mortal, these diverse levels are undoubtedly more or less unified and made personally meaningful by the unobserved and mysterious operations of the divine Thought-Adjuster.
Okay, so two things there, the sequence giving you the hierarchy, yeah, and you know, you can, you know, say, well, like the lower order of angels that are unrevealed, you know, where they would fit in. Well, you know, maybe they go in between secondary midwares and primary midwares, say, or, you know, you can start to speculate like that. You know, we mentioned, you know, back there, they brought up the Marantia companions. Remember in the first section there, those fit in. You have Marantia cherubim, and then Marantia companions, and then mid-phase cherubim. So they fit into that hierarchy too. So you got that definite hierarchy of energies for bodies, and notice what they brought in the Thought-Adjuster. Spans that hierarchy. So how handy would that be if you had a high being that needed to input a paper and have it come down the elevator of the adjuster down to the bottom of this hierarchy and be fed into a contact personality's mind? They're reminding you of that fact. See that the Thought-Adjuster spans that whole vertical hierarchy. And that's why it can do a lot of the things that it can do. All right. And, you know, and you'll eventually have access to such, you know, vertical level transcending nature. You know, as a finaliter, you still can engage that which is all the way down at the lowest levels. All right?
On normal worlds, the primary midwayers maintain their service as the intelligence group. And as celestial entertainers in behalf of the planetary prince. While the secondary ministers continue their cooperation with the Adamic regime of furthering the cause of progressive planetary civilization. In case of the defection of the planetary prince and the failure of the material sun, as occurred on Urantia, the midway creatures become the wards of the system sovereign and serve under the directing guidance of the acting custodian of the planet. But on only three other worlds in Satania, do these beings function as one group unified under unified leadership, as do the United Midway Ministers of Urantia?
Okay, so that whole United Midwayers thing is relatively unique. And remember we mentioned what are normally secondary midwayers up to? While the secondary ministers continue their cooperation with the Adamic regime of furthering the cause of progressive planetary civilization. So in other words, we didn't need a lot of that help here by nature. That's why we got so few of them. So you can reflect on that. Let's see, anything else there? The thing that they don't answer is there something special about the synchronization between the primaries and secondaries here that they can be one of the four worlds in Satania where they're together, or is that just, you know, the way things ended up in the wake of rebellion and default? They needed to do it here. Again, it's kind of just open for speculation about why that is, but okay, let's get some more here.
The planetary work of both primary and secondary midwayers is varied and diverse on the numerous individual worlds of a universe. But on the normal and average planets, their activities are very different from the duties which occupy their time on isolated spheres such as Urantia.
Go ahead and read another
one. The primary midwayers are the planetary historians who, from the time of the arrival of the planetary prince to the age of settled light and life, formulate the pageants and design the portrayals of planetary history for the exhibits of the planets on the system headquarters worlds.
So that's, you know, a little loose end that may have been dangling in your mind. You know, it's like, who exactly is collecting all the information that gets put into that mural? And so that's normally the primary midwayer's job. So the fact that we, you know, lost basically 4/5 of ours. See, that brings in, it's like, well, how is that being handled now? You know, an open question there.
You want me to finish?
Is there anything in that previous one? We pointed that out, that obviously you can't look at what it says about what the primaries and secondaries are up to here, you know, and have any idea of what the norm is. And so that's why they're giving you a little bit about the norm right here. Mm-hmm.
Midwayers remain for long periods on an inhabited world, but if faithful to their trust, they will eventually and most certainly be recognized for their age-long service in maintaining the sovereignty of the Creator Sun. They will be duly rewarded for their patient ministry to the material mortals on their world of time and space. Sooner or later, all accredited Midway creatures will be mustered into the ranks of the ascending sons of God and will be duly initiated into the long adventure of the Paradise Ascent in company with those very mortals of animal origin, their earth brethren, whom they so jealously guarded and so effectively served during the long planetary sojourn. Presented by a Melchizedek acting by request of the chief of the seraphic host of Nebadon.
Okay, yeah, so just, yeah, that's pretty straightforward. So they, like I was saying, they eventually... during this stages of light and life, will get modified and become ascending sons, like we were talking before there. And when all is said and done, they end up not that different from us, and can be part of the mortal core of the finality. Okay, and then the last little part there, just, you know, we've been noting this every time. So Melchizedek wrote this. Is he one of the on the 12 members of the Revelatory Commission? No, he obviously not. But apparently the chief of Seraphic Host of Nebadon is one of those 12. Right? And so the chief of Seraphic Hosts pointed to a Melchizedek and said, I've got a job for you. I need you to write two papers, paper 38 and paper 39. All right. Next time we'll get into that thing that I forgot to mention up front about the seven orders of seraphim, and we'll see what that's all about. Let's take a moment here.